Welcome to a brand new episode.
Mike Driscoll, The Python Show.
Hello and welcome to The Python Show with your host, Mike Driscoll. Today I welcome my guest, Sebastian, who is a researcher, and I believe you work for Lightning AI now. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And yeah, thanks for inviting me onto your show. So yeah, I'm currently a researcher, technically a research engineer. But what I do is essentially research, coding, and all the fun stuff at Lightning AI.
And you also like to write multiple books, as I recall.
Yep, occasionally, like maybe once a year. No, not that often, but I do like writing a lot. It's like for me, like a way to organize my thoughts, write about things I'm excited about. That's usually what I do. I write about things I'm excited about, and then I like sharing them with others. And it's usually a fun process for me. Of course, when there are deadlines, it can sometimes be a bit, intense, but most of the time, 99% of the time, I really enjoy writing. Yep.
How many books do you have out now anyway?
That goes back a long time. I think I started as a student. I was an undergrad student when I wrote a book on R. That was just like plotting heat maps in R. And that was super exciting when the publisher approached me to write a book. I was like, wow, that's so amazing. Like, and then it was a very small book. I would even not call it a book. I would call it a pamphlet maybe, because it's just like 50 pages or something. And that was like 2012, 13-ish. And then I wrote the Python machine learning book in 2015. And it was like a new edition every 2 years, like updating it, adding more chapters, because also the deep learning field evolved. I think the biggest update was 2022 when before everything was in TensorFlow, and we moved that over to PyTorch, which is what I'm using for 99% of my work. And then actually I have a copy here because I just got my author's copy. So for those, if there's a video, watch the video. I have a new book. It's called Machine Learning Q and AI, which is, it's like almost the outtakes from my other books or my teaching, where I'm covering like more advanced, let's say intermediate to advanced machine learning and deep learning concepts. And that's like 30 short chapters explaining from everything like evaluating machine learning models, the difference between convolution networks and vision transformers, and all these things that didn't quite, neatly fit into an introduction. It's more like for advanced users and right now, because I don't know, I really like writing. Like I said, I'm working on building a large language model from Scratchbook, where I'm it's basically 8 chapters, step by step, building something like, let's say, ChatGPT, starting out with implementing everything from scratch. So from scratch would be PyTorch, but like not, using any other third-party libraries, really like coding the attention mechanism, the data input pipeline, really from really low-level building blocks, and then pre-training the model. Loading also pre-trained weights, because pre-training is very expensive if you want to pre-train a GPT model. And then, but also then the fine-tuning and the alignment steps so that it can follow instructions. So it's really like for people who want to understand LLMs, it's really walking you through all the steps without, let's say, using external libraries, so that you can understand how an LLM works by doing it yourself almost. Yeah, if that makes sense. Yeah.
When will that come out?
That will be 2025-ish. So right now, as we speak, I'm currently finishing chapter 5 out of 8, and I'm planning, if things go smoothly, to have everything out by August. But then of course it takes several months for the publisher to put everything into the final layout, and there are several stages involved, and then the print version will be hopefully available early 2025. But for people who are interested in that, there is a early access version, and I also have all the code on GitHub. So for people who want to follow along, I have a GitHub repository where I post all the chapters as code with notes. It's not as detailed as the book, but you can follow along with the code and the notes. And and there's the early access version, so there are lots of readers already who are very excited always about the next chapter, because it's a hot topic, and it's kind of fun to code. Like you as a Python coder, you know how much fun it can be to code things from the ground up.
I'm curious, are any of your books like written for someone who doesn't know anything about machine learning or anything like that, or AI? Can they actually take one of your books and just understand it, or are they going to have to go like take a course before they read your book?
So for the Python machine learning book and the newest edition, Machine Learning with PyTorch and Scikit-Learn, I would say that is for Python programmers who are curious about getting into machine learning, because it starts with scikit-learn, like machine learning, and then building up to deep neural networks. I would say for that, that's perfect for like a Python programmer. I must say, though, there is a bit of math in there, but you don't have to, I would say, go over all the nitty-gritty details. So the big picture, I think you don't really need that much of a background in, let's say, machine learning or something. It's basically to introduce you to machine learning. The machine learning Q&AI book I mentioned, that is coming out in the next couple of weeks, where I just got the author copies. I think that one I would recommend, it's more like a follow-up book. I would recommend like an introductory machine learning or deep learning course. And for the building LLMs from scratch book, for that one, I'm hoping one can read it without a background in machine learning, because I'm explaining all the steps, like from predicting, let's say, when you're pre-training the next word in the sentence and how that works. There might be some, some black boxes. So where in PyTorch we, let's say, use the optimization autograd function in PyTorch for the backpropagation, where it's like loss.backward, and then let's say some magic happens where the gradients get calculated, because that's something, if you were to implement that one from scratch, that would be yet another book, basically. Otherwise, the LLM part itself, I think it should make sense even if you don't have a background in machine learning. So it's basically really building blocks. And I'm also, so far as I know, I don't think I have much math in there. It's really, really explaining everything with code. So I think, for a programmer, this would be, I think, a fine book to pick up without a deep knowledge in deep learning. However, it never hurts to have a deep learning background. So I added also an appendix to that one. It's like a 45 pages introduction to PyTorch, just like the, big picture overview of the things, let's say the essential things you need to or should know if you use PyTorch, but not like 3 hours, or maybe it's 3 hours, but maybe not 30 hours of background material, like read this book first, then read that book first. It's really, hopefully self-contained. Yeah.
Well, that's cool, because I think I own your PyTorch book, and I'm like, am I going to be able to read this? I just haven't gotten around to actually opening it up.
Yeah, it's a big book.
Yeah, it's a little intimidating, and I'm like, I don't even know if I'm going to understand this one, but I want to read it, so...
No, I think it's, one step at a time. It's a big book. I realize I went maybe a bit overboard with that, so I can see why that's intimidating a bit. Yeah.
Well, when you're reading about machine learning and LLMs and all that stuff, there's a lot of terminology, and that is very intimidating. And so it makes you wonder, am I advanced enough in my programming to be able to understand these books? Or, some people say you have to go take statistics, or you have to go do a bunch of classes before you can actually start understanding these books. And I'm like, is that really true? So I thought, I'll ask the expert.
I would say it's hard for someone, looking back, to really say what is, let's say, a requirement. But I would say it's possible without too much background, I hope. I mean, like you said, there's a lot of terminology, but I would say a lot of the terminology is just like, I would say jargon. It's like, it's just making it sound fancier than it really is, maybe. I mean, for example, I have also a background in statistics. Since you mentioned statistics, I was a professor at UW Madison in statistics, and there are these terms, so when I was teaching students, that are confusing because they mean something different. So I was teaching machine learning classes in the department of statistics, and machine learning and statistics, you might think it's kind of very it's closely related, but then you use different terms to mean the same thing, and you use the same term to mean different things too. So, for example, in machine learning, you say something like, "We use the model for inference," which is interesting because the use inference is very different from the use inference in machine learning, in statistics. So in statistics, you talk about distributions and so forth with inference. And in machine learning, when you use the term inference, you mean usually prediction. So you use the model for prediction. If you just, let's say, train a model and then you use the model in inference, it just means, yeah, you apply the model on some data to get some class labels, for example. In machine learning, in LLMs, you would generate the next word. So it has not that much to do with the terms inference and statistics. That's what makes it, I think, a bit, making it look a bit more complicated than it really is. It's just like, it's like a vocabulary that once you have the vocabulary, like a mapping of what it means, then I think it's not that complicated. It's just, it's just like this little small language that you almost have to learn in order to know what people mean. Yeah.
I think that's true. If you go into DevOps or, web programming, they all have their own terminology and you just have to learn it. So I kind of went at this backwards. Normally when I start out and talking with somebody, I have them tell me a little bit about, how they got into programming. So maybe you could just give us a little background history about yourself.
That's a long time ago, but when I remember correctly, I started out either with Bash, Perl, or R, or all of these things combined. I was working, I was doing basically a lab rotation as an undergrad in a computational biology lab. And for that, we needed to do a lot of, statistical analyses, but also data processing. And for the statistical parts, I usually used R for plotting and forth and, calculating basic statistics. And then Bash and Perl scripts basically for the data munging, like getting the data into the right shape. I had in biology, you have very unstructured data often. And just to get that into a table form so that you can analyze that. And I inherited, or the lab had a lot of scripts based on Perl and Bash, which I try to teach myself. I think these days it must be so much more easy if you use just, ChatGPT. I think that is something where I spend a lot of time on just, doing some very boilerplate code stuff to get the data into the right form. I think nowadays with LLM, that might actually be something to automate. But so that was the time where I had these very, Frankenstein complex setups, like one passes some output to the other, and it was not very pretty. But that was the time where I heard about Python, and I started learning Python, and that was basically also the time where I almost moved everything over to Python, and I became a Python programmer back then. I think it was 2012-ish, and I took Python classes later in college, but I must say I'm mostly self-taught, where I taught it myself, then maybe took a class later, but mostly I think it was basically teaching it myself. And then I took also C++ classes and stuff, but I almost, and Java too, but I forgot almost all of it. So I'm almost exclusively Python coding these days, basically. Yeah,
I can understand that. I had a lot of classes and I don't remember most of what I learned in those now.
So. Yeah, and I think also with Python, you can go a long way. I mean, the one thing is always people say, of course, it's inefficient for certain things because it's more like a higher level thing. But especially also for deep learning, we say, okay, we use Python when you use something like PyTorch, but Python is really just like the glue language, the wrapper language, beyond the Python usage, you have all the CUDA code. So CUDA is the NVIDIA library, CUDA and cuDNN. It's cuDNN is the CUDA for deep neural networks. And it's basically all the functions implemented in very efficient CUDA code. And when you use PyTorch, for example, you write it in a language that looks like Python, but really what happens under the hood, it is calling these efficient functions in CUDA. And if you don't run on a GPU, if you run on a CPU, it's also very low-level code. It's, I think, mostly C and C++ code under the hood. Mm-hmm. So also in NumPy or scikit-learn, really Python is more like, I would say, the layer in between the programmer and the efficient implementation, I would say. So in that sense, I would say there's almost no need for someone to use anything else but Python, like for deep learning, except maybe you want to write these very efficient functions yourself. For that, of course, then you would have to learn CUDA to some extent. But most of the time, for me, I don't know CUDA. I mean, I know it a little bit, but I wouldn't be able to write efficient CUDA code. So, and it's totally fine for my use cases. Yeah.
Yeah, I think people have this idea that you have to learn C++ or you have to learn Rust to get down to that level, and Python just abstracts that away for you.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned Rust, I think, that is true. I think there are a couple of packages now. Polars, it's like a replacement for Pandas, which is based on Rust, which is more efficient. But again, you write the code in a Python language. You don't, unless you are writing the library Polars, you don't have to know Rust, really. And also, in my LLMs from scratch book, the first or second chapter, we're implementing a tokenizer, which tokenizes the text into token IDs, which are then embedded by the LLM embedding layer. And for that, everything is in PyTorch to explain it, but it's the one external library I'm using. I'm using a library called TickToken, which is based on Rust. So it's like tokenizing the text just a bit faster, but you could technically also do it in Python. It's just like, there are some efficiency gains, but unless you're developing this library, usually you don't have to worry about it, I would say. So usually someone else is worried about that already. Yeah,
that makes sense. So could you tell us a little bit about what your favorite Python packages are?
I mentioned PyTorch quite a lot, and I would say that is my favorite language, or package, I mean. It's it's something I use every day, most of the day. It's basically... So also for people who think PyTorch is a deep learning package, that is correct. But you, for those who have not used it yet, you can think of it as almost like something like NumPy. So NumPy is a numerical array library, and it's essentially PyTorch packages three things together. It's basically this array library. So tensors, like the term tensor, like in TensorFlow or in PyTorch, it's essentially just a multi-dimensional array. It's like in Python, a list with multiple dimensions, basically, and a data container. And that is one aspect. So PyTorch is this array library or tensor library, but then it has also like these utilities for deep learning. So some neural network layers, they are, let's say, provided already. So it saves you some work to do it manually. And then it's also like mathematically like a automatic differentiation library to compute, if you remember this from high school classes or calculus classes, the backpropagation, computing of derivatives, function derivatives. To compute the derivative of the loss with respect to the weights, or basically the gradients, which are derivatives in multiple dimensions. And PyTorch combines these things. So it's like a very almost self-contained, useful library for deep learning because you have all the three things. Tensors, the automatic differentiation, and the deep learning utilities that make your life easier. So I would say that is my favorite library, but I also still use a lot of NumPy. So NumPy is usually when I just need to do something very quick and simple. I don't even need to import PyTorch because NumPy is almost like muscle memory at this point. So if I just do something quick, I use NumPy. Pandas is also a favorite library where we just talked about Polars, which is a bit more efficient. But again, it's muscle memory where I have used Pandas for so many years that I'm just quicker to just do something in Pandas. And most of the time, to be honest, when I do these things, it's not about the computational efficiency, but more like the programmer efficiency. Like, okay, I could use, let's say, Polars. It runs, 5 times faster. But the thing I need to run, it only runs like for, let's say, 10 minutes anyway. So if it runs in 10 minutes or 15 minutes, that's usually not a big deal because I have so many other things I can do in the meantime. So I'm just writing the code, getting it done, and and the other thing is Matplotlib. So Matplotlib is... Okay. It has been around forever. It's like a plotting library, but it's still my go-to. There are so many other alternatives, but again, muscle memory. It always goes back to Matplotlib, something simple like visualizing some basic plots. And And these, I would say, are my favorite packages that I have been around for, well, have been with me for like almost my whole career, except PyTorch, which is newer. And other packages I also use and like are based on, like, basically PyTorch is a lower level deep learning framework, I would almost say. And there's PyTorch Lightning. It's like an open source library that we develop at Lightning AI, which is like making certain things more convenient. It's like, you know, if you have used Keras, like how Keras is around TensorFlow, PyTorch Lightning sits on top of PyTorch. The API and design is very different from Keras, but it's like the same idea of in terms of making it more convenient to write higher level code. So for example, what makes it more convenient is it has automatic checkpointing. If your training crashes, you can continue the last model checkpoint, which is very important for deep neural networks, for example, that take a lot of time and money to train. For example, if you heard of Stable Diffusion, so Stable Diffusion is like a diffusion model to generate images, and they also use PyTorch Lightning, for example, to train it because it's like this big system. And yeah, PyTorch Lightning makes it a bit easier to manage. It's also very convenient to run on multiple GPUs or multiple even nodes, like compute nodes. And it's basically like an abstraction layer that makes all the distributed computing or efficiency stuff that you would have to implement in PyTorch with a lot of lines of code. It makes it a bit more easy for users. So instead of writing 100 lines of code to write this distributed code, you just do it's like one line of code that you insert there, and it just works basically. So yeah, that is nice. A library that I use a lot too. Yeah, and the maybe one more is because I have been working on it today or the last couple of days. It's a LitGPT, which is another open source repository we develop at Lightning AI. It's essentially a open source repository for LLMs, where it's like the focus is to keep the code readable and hackable, and but also implement state-of-the-art LLMs, so loading the weights of, let's say, Google Gemma, Mistral, Llama, so that you can run LLMs on your own machine, but also you can fine-tune them and pre-train them. And it's essentially a library or a repository that we are maintaining to have a bit of a different focus than other libraries. There are great other libraries out there, like Transformers and Llama and others, but the focus here is really code readability in terms of for the developer. If you have a research idea, to go into the code and just implement it simply. It's like something we also use ourselves a lot, and I use a lot for my research. Yeah. So there was a lot of information, maybe. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's all good. Do you use LitGPT to like create a GPT type interface? Is that what that's for, or is it just? I don't quite understand what you use it for. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so not quite. So it is still, I would say, PyTorch code. So the interface is still, so right now we are going, when this podcast is out, it's probably already finished, but we are transitioning right now the interface from a script-based interface where you call a script to more like a command line interface. But it is essentially, you say, I don't know, LitGPT, fine-tune LoRa, where LoRa is a parameter-efficient method, and it runs this LoRa fine-tuning, and you can provide the data set and the hyperparameters. So it's not a human interface to LLMs. It's more to have the files small and self-contained. So if you are a coder, you know where to make the changes to achieve certain outputs or results. So for example, the Hugging Face Transformer library is more like a Python library where you import the models, and then you have a trainer.fit method to fit or train the model. But if you want to develop a new training methodology or change the training loop, if you go into this trainer class, the PyTorch trainer class of the Transformer library, it's a very large code base. It's thousands or, I don't know, tens of thousands of lines of code and distributed across multiple files. And it is, in that sense, it's a library that is easy to use if you use the tools that are provided. But it's not so trivial if you are a researcher and you want to, let's say, implement a new type of learning algorithm or LLM or something like that. So in that case, it would be a bit more, I would say, complex to figure that out. And so in LitGPT, it's more like meant for that, for quick prototyping. If you want to develop new features, benchmark something, you can more easily change the code. But the interface is still a code interface. It's not like a human interface to LLMs. Yeah, it's just making that efficient and from a coding perspective, yeah, to be able to make, to implement research ideas, essentially.
That makes sense. So circling back to your book writing, do you find that there are certain topics that are harder to explain than others? And if so, what do you think is like the hardest?
I think sometimes it's hard to explain things that are hard to visualize. So for example, for the LLMs from Scratchbook, when you talk about embeddings, it's just a first thing on my mind because it's in the basically the first chapter after the introduction. An embedding in LLMs, it's you are embedding a token, a word or a text snippet into a high dimensional space. And this is usually, depending on the LLM, let's say 768 or more than 1,000 dimensions. And you can't really visualize a 1,000 dimensional space. When you do a plot in Matplotlib, for example, it's or humans, when you think about what dimensions we are capable of thinking about, it's usually one dimension, two dimensions, three dimensions. Four dimensional spaces is already something we can't really visualize. So it's like, and then imagine visualizing a 1,000 dimensional space. So in that sense, it's hard to somehow, I would say, visualize that, but there are tricks around that. So you have to think about workarounds. Okay, you can say this figure embeds this token in a two-dimensional space. But this is only for educational purposes. Now the LLM is doing that in 10,000 dimensions, for example, or 1,000 dimensions. So it's like that, I would say, is usually the most challenging part, because when you make a simple example, the simple example is intuitive, but it's not quite the real example. So you have to always then think about, is this sufficient? But okay, two-dimensional spaces would work for the visualization, but if I train the LLM with that, it would not be a very good LLM, you know? So it's like this trade-off, like between making it simple for educational purposes to understand things and to visualize things, but then also making the connection to the real, case, and also making sure, it still works, basically, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I mean, even when you're reading it, you're like, what is going on here? It's so hard to get into your head. You know, what does that mean for 10,000 dimensions or, you know, whatever? It's like, it's very abstract. Let's put it that way.
It is, yeah. It can be, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's see. How have you seen AI changing the way you write your books or do your research?
But I've done that also already a couple of years ago. I am using a grammar checker, for example, to fix spelling. So if you were referring to that, because I'm not a native speaker. So for me, that's very important because it's like, it's really a lifesaver to be able to sometimes check my spelling. Spelling maybe not so much because most words I've already seen so many times that it makes sense, but it's still, for me as a non-native speaker, sometimes like prepositions or like certain grammar structures are like, is it off or from or something like that? It's like, usually I just use a grammar tool sometimes and, it figures it out. So if I see I can see it's correct, but sometimes when you do it from scratch, for me, it's sometimes as a non-native speaker, it's not 100% clear. So in that sense, it happened. I would say I need to use it less frequently than I used to, like 10 years ago. But that is one thing where I use AI for. Sometimes also, I think when I'm writing, it's I'm very verbose, where I write very, very long texts, where I'm like, okay, this is way too long. And when you write a book, there's also sometimes page limits and so forth. So I do use AI sometimes to say, can you try to shorten this paragraph? I provided my paragraph, and then it sometimes comes up with a good, let's say, condensed form of what I've written. Sometimes I don't like it at all. It really depends on what you provided with. But then also what I usually do is it shortens it. I don't like certain words it uses. For example, what's funny is GPT or ChatGPT uses always the word delve. So in this section, we delve into something and then we delve into that. And it's like, it sounds kind of weird. So I also then often take that shortened version and then rewrite it again myself. And, you know, it's like an interaction with AI. It's like, I don't take the results verbatim. I usually edit them, but sometimes it is actually useful to have something like that where it saves you a lot of brain power, where you know what you want to, or you have written it already, you just want to rephrase that. And for that, I think an AI is really good. So I'm kind of, it makes me more productive, I would say, to do it like that instead of banging my head against something where I'm like, how can I say that same thing differently, you know?
Yeah, I like using Grammarly that way because you can tell it, I want to write an active voice versus passive voice. And I think active voice doesn't come naturally to me. So it's helpful to have it say, oh, this isn't right. You need to rewrite this. And it doesn't usually give you good examples if you're too passive in the way you write. It just highlights and says, this is wrong. And so you have to go back and fix it until it's happy again.
Yeah, I know what you mean also because passive voice was how I learned to write papers back then in college. And but then for my blog posts and books, I'm also preferring more the active voice and also for papers these days. And it is sometimes easy to just write in passive voice because somehow it's easier. And then it's more an active challenge to write in active voice.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know why it's harder sometimes. Sometimes I'm really good at it. And other days I just fail completely. Anyway, do you have any tips for staying current with tech and AI? Because that seems to change all the time.
Oh, yeah. It's a very, very fast-moving field. And I would say keeping up with AI, it can be a full-time job if you want it to be because there's so much to read and so much to process. Personally, I try to keep on top of things, but I have like almost a set time limit. Usually half an hour a day. I set aside to just browse through recent papers. I collect them. I write down everything. I mean, I wouldn't say I write it down, but I collect everything in text files or in my notes where if I need it later, I know where it is. And I usually bookmark so many things that are interesting, maybe 100 papers a month or something, but I don't read all of them. It's impossible. Yeah. But you know what exists. If you need it, you can go there and read it. It's just useful, though, to see what these papers are sometimes. So it's like to get an overview where the field is headed and what exists. And a lot of that is also very similar and almost duplicated, which is actually good because if two people or more come up with the same results or similar methods, it means basically there's probably something important behind these methods or something that works well. So there's like, it's actually not a bad thing if you have duplicated research, basically. I was also a moderator at Archive, the repository for papers a few years ago for the machine learning category. And there, what we had to do is every day basically scanning through the titles of each paper to make sure they are categorized correctly. So we did use machine learning to categorize the papers, but machine learning is also not perfect. It was like, I would say, 98% accurate. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people, they use the wrong category when they submit articles, and sometimes people submit things that are not articles. So to some extent, you can catch that with machine learning also, but it's not perfect. So we were always scanning through the titles. And over the years, it became always longer. It was, when I started, I think it was 2019, it was like 100 papers a day. And then towards the end, like 2022 or 21, it was almost 200. And at conference times, sometimes even 400 papers a day. So just 400, imagine 400 papers on machine learning, new methods each day. And it's quite a fast moving field. And from there, I also kind of kept the habit of just skimming over the titles sometimes. So I don't do that every day, but a couple of times a week, I just scroll through the new releases in Archive and just highlight some of them that I may want to read later. And I usually pick, I would say, 5 to 10 papers I read a month. So it's like one or two papers a week, basically. So so to make it manageable, because there's always something interesting also besides the method to learn. Like there's usually something I could use for my own work, or in, so I like that a lot. And I usually on Substack, I also I try every month to write like a summary of things I found interesting, but it's really only a small subsection of things that are out there. So yeah. I don't have a great tip for keeping up, but I would say just skimming through things and just getting getting a feel of what's out there. But I think it's not feasible to read all of it. It's impossible. I think also it's maybe not necessary, because if you work on a project, I think the best way is usually you start your project, you work on something, you come up with your own ideas, and if you get stuck at that point, maybe reading about other methods and then seeing what's worth it, what's worth exploring. It's also sometimes students ask me how to read a paper, and I think also that's related to the project, because I don't keep general notes most of the time, because I sometimes read a paper multiple times and I come away with many different types of conclusions or interesting notes depending on. On the context, why am I reading this paper? So sometimes I am interested in a project, for example, I feel like I need to try out a different learning rate scheduler. So I'm reading LLM papers and see what have they used for learning rate scheduling, for example. And sometimes I just read about, okay, what is the data set they used, or what is something else? So, or what is the evaluation method? When I care about the evaluation section, I would read multiple papers, but then maybe only focus on the benchmark evaluation sections to come up with ideas I could use or adopt. And so I think in that sense, sometimes it's useful to read the paper completely and in detail, but often it's really project and goal specific, where you have different reasons or different sections you are interested in. So that's one thing also to keep in mind, that I think is no fundamentally correct or wrong way to read a paper. It's really depending on why you're reading the paper almost.
You know, I've read it, I keep seeing it on social media and the like, that you can use like ChatGPT or Google Bard to summarize an article. Do you think there's some, have you ever tried that to see if it does a good job of summarizing, or if it just makes things up?
I would say it is okay-ish. I mentioned my Substack articles, and at the end of each Substack article, I have always like 30, 40 papers I found interesting, where I'm just summarizing them in one sentence. So to make it, because the articles are already 6,000 words, so I don't, it's just to have just a list of references. And I used or tried to use AI for that, and sometimes it works. So usually what I do is I read the abstract or browse through the paper quickly, and then I provide the paper with the abstract and say, summarize this. Sometimes it does a good job, but often it also highlights things I would not highlight. And maybe I wouldn't say it's bad. It's just I find things. So let's say the AI tries to do more like a general job of capturing everything, where for me, I'm more like I'm interested in a smaller subset of things that I focus on. So I think that comes back to the idea I mentioned before, like everyone, if they read a paper, everyone has probably a different thing they find interesting when they are reading the paper. And so AI can be useful for that if you want the general takeaway. But I think, it is not like general. It's very general. It's maybe not. Yeah,
it's not personal.
Yeah, it's not personal. Maybe that's the good way to put it.
It's not. Oh, maybe I should say it's not opinionated, because if I'm going to talk about an article, I'm going to be like, I really like it because this, this, and this, and ChatGPT is going to be like, here's the general overview,
And it can be actually. I think for the great denominator, if you're the most common denominator, it is maybe trying to do something that appeals to most people, but you could probably make it more personal if you show it more examples, like if you give it an article and you say, I summarized it like this, and you do that for hundreds of articles, it would probably learn what you find interesting in that article and come up with some more close with a summary that is more closer to what you would write. But yeah, that might be possible. I have not tried that yet because, to be honest, I also enjoy reading too much. So it's it would be kind of sad if I would just read AI summaries. So I do still like reading the papers also. Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, let's not take away the fun. I mean, I like to read too. So, all right. So let's change the topic completely, and you can tell me what your favorite non-technical hobby is, and why do you like it?
I must say I don't have too many, but one thing I really like is cross-country skiing. I live in Wisconsin.
Oh, wow.
And it is usually a very long winter. So to get the best out of it, my wife and I, we got cross-country skis like 3-4 years ago. And we go now every year. We have beautiful state parks. And it's usually awesome. It's fun. It's relaxing to just go into the nature and do some cross-country skiing. And other than that, when I was a student, I was really, I grew up basically with video games. I don't play recent video games that often, but I do like still old school retro games. That's also something, reading books, retro games, getting some exercise. These are my, I would say, non-technical hobbies, although video games is almost back to a screen and technical things, right?
Yeah, I guess. But it's still fun. And it's not coding. It's just relaxing.
Yeah, I do like reading books. I do both usually, but it is something like video games is where it occupies your brain enough so that you, let's say, don't think about work, because it's usually like a puzzle game where you try to solve puzzles in that game. But it's also like relaxing enough or fun enough that it's not like really requiring all your brain cells to do it. It's like a nice balance, I think, between some fun puzzle that keeps you interested and entertained, but then also distracts you from thinking only about work, basically. Yeah,
That makes sense. Well, cool. Thanks. I think we've reached the end of my questions, so I just want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Sebastian.
Yeah, thanks so much for the invitation, Mike. That was a super interesting, almost 1 hour chat. I really enjoyed it. It had a lot of fun. And maybe one day if you have more questions, happy to be back. It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure I'll have more questions because AI keeps changing. So I'll be glad to have you back again.
Yeah, thanks for the invite and looking forward to this.
Yeah, no problem. And for all of you listeners, I'm going to provide links to some of Sebastian's works in his Substack so you can all check out his cool writings as well.
Make sure to leave a review. This makes our day and fuels future episodes.
Mike Driscoll, The Python Show.